So the European debt crisis includes Portugal and Greece.
And now perhaps some other countries that we thought were in good shape.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Wednesday, November 16th.
All right, coming up, answers to some questions.
China's economy is just rolling along, but can that ward off a global recession?
Can U.S. manufacturing jobs still offer a ticket to the middle class?
What could stop U.S. consumers from spending this holiday season? Here's a hint, Steve. It's a three-letter word, and it rhymes with foil.
Okay, I'll have to think about it. And what could happen if you lie, Jeremy, about your weight on a social network website?
We'll have to find out in just a few minutes right here on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The price of oil rose above 100 bucks a barrel in New York trading this morning. That's up about 20% in a little more than a month.
And that's where we'll start with our regular Wednesday analyst, Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. He is with us from New York, as he is every Wednesday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Josh, why this steep rise in oil prices?
I think a lot of what you're seeing is not so much to do with commercial or industrial demand, but speculators in the market. The CFTC just put out their commitment of traders report, and they're showing that hedge funds have increased their crude oil bullish bets by 7.2% into last week. That is a high since May.
So these are investors that are just trying to make money by betting on what the price of oil is going to do, not necessarily driven by supply and demand, but I assume it still has a pretty big impact on the global economy if oil prices go higher.
That's the unfortunate part of this. So the threshold for where the consumer starts to cut back, they say, is somewhere around the $5 per gallon of gasoline, which would equate to a touch over $100 crude. So the last thing we want to see is speculators driving prices to the point where it affects the economy.
Well, Josh, we've heard this story before, of course. Are we in any better shape to deal with higher oil prices now than we were, say, 3 years ago?
Probably not. I think the big problem is that the government has made bets on solar and wind. There are subsidies for ethanol. But really what we could have done and we could still do is something with nat gas trucking. I think that would move the needle and have a much more ameliorative impact.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, despite the rise in oil prices, Americans are paying less, or at least were paying less, last month for things like gasoline and cars. The government says the nation's consumer price index was down slightly in October, 0.1%. That is, by the way, the first drop since June. We also got word today on the nation's industrial production. U.S. factories made more cars and electronics and equipment last month as overall output rose. Lawmakers in Washington are paying close attention to that because there's a big hearing on Capitol Hill about how big a role our manufacturing sector can play when it comes to job growth.
But no need to wait for that hearing, Steve, because our Economy 4.0 correspondent David Brancaccio has already been looking into that for part of his series, which examines how the new economy can better serve more people. David joins us now. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So is manufacturing a place that we can really look for jobs in the future, or is it dead or dying in this country?
Well, the stereotype is it's gone, right? All the jobs have gone somewhere else. Actually, 10 million Americans work in manufacturing now. And here's the news of the week. A new report calculates that there will be 3 million openings in manufacturing between now and the year 2018, which is not chicken feed.
And that's 3 million new jobs? These are jobs that are being created?
Not really job creation. That's the trick here, Jeremy. It's more like job, what should I call it, rotation. The main reason for these 3 million openings is because a lot of people currently working in manufacturing are boomers, baby boomers, and they're going to hit retirement. The actual number of jobs is actually down over the next 10 years. But still, lots of opportunity as the older folks get out of there.
Well, and when those baby boomers took those manufacturing jobs decades ago, perhaps, it really was seen as a ticket to the middle class. Is that going to be the case for the new people who are applying and getting these manufacturing jobs?
Well, right. Remember, you could get out of high school and you could maybe find a job as a machinist that would pay, okay, $42,000 a year or something like that. But I talked to Anthony Carnevale, the director of the Center on Education and the Workforce at Georgetown. The current situation is like this.
Nowadays, high school degree, high school skill level is not good enough.
Nowadays, you got to have at least 2 more years, if not 4 more years. And even if the factory is going to offer you on-the-job training, they're typically going to want to see at least 2 more years after high school.
So what needs to be done, David? How do we move forward in the world of manufacturing in the United States?
Well, it's the fourth largest sector of the economy, manufacturing. And Carnevale said this.
The fact that there are so many jobs there means you just don't walk away. It is the industry that's too big to fail, not Wall Street.
So he's not suggesting a bailout, but some kind of government incentives of the sort that we give, for instance, to the energy industry.
All right. Marketplace Economy 4.0 correspondent David Brancaccio, thanks so much.
Of course.
In Washington today, the House Judiciary Committee holds a hearing on the Stop Online Piracy Act, SOPA as it's known, which would give the government a lot more power to enforce copyrights online for things like movies and medicines. But that bill is dividing the business community, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The bill would require search engines like Google to cut off links to websites that sell pirated videos and fake Viagra. The Chamber of Commerce has gone all out for the bill. It's hosted fly-ins to Washington so Hollywood bigwigs can lobby Congress personally. Stephen Tepp is an intellectual property attorney at the Chamber.
The idea is that you want to cut off these rogue sites from the U.S. marketplace.
The Chamber's activism has made some of its members, like Hollywood studios and the pharmaceutical industry, very happy. But it's alienated members like Google. They're funding advocacy groups like Public Knowledge. Gigi Sohn heads Public Knowledge.
This will essentially force search engines to become the copyright police for the first time.
Sohn says Google would have to ferret out sites selling pirated products, a huge undertaking. Sohn played down reports that Google might quit the chamber. Google won't comment. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Well, the housing market giveth and the housing market taketh away. Mm. Applications for home mortgages fell last week, which negated the gains of the week before. The Mortgage Bankers Association said mortgage apps dropped by 10%, which almost completely wiped out the rise of 10.3% 2 weeks ago.
Clothing store to the young, thin, and ripped, Jeremy, Abercrombie & Fitch. I know this is a place you shop all the time.
Oh, yeah, I'm always there. Every day I'm over at Abercrombie & Fitch. You know what the thing about Abercrombie & Fitch is? You always tell where there is one because that cologne,
the smell,
just emanates for blocks and blocks.
They pump out the cologne. Absolutely. By the way, A&F said today its profit edged up in the third quarter. Apparently they're doing something right, Jeremy. That cologne is bringing the people in droves.
People in.
But its earnings fell short of Wall Street expectations. I guess not enough demand for stripes. Who knows? You can find more numbers anytime at our website, the all-new marketplace.org.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
And now the Marketplace global perspective. It has not been a pretty 24 hours in the bond markets, which determine the borrowing costs for Eurozone governments. Investors have been dumping bonds, and not just from the usual suspects like Italy and Greece. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
The sell-off spread to some of the stalwart economies that we don't often hear about, like Finland, Austria, and the Netherlands. These countries have a AAA credit rating, but investors now seem to fear that rating is at risk. These countries, along with Germany, may have to bear the additional crushing burden of trying to bail out Italy. So their creditworthiness is now in jeopardy. Steve Barrow is a currency strategist with Standard Bank.
The more that this crisis eats into the core of the Eurozone, countries like France and Belgium and the Netherlands, then the more difficult it will be for policymakers to solve the crisis.
One paradox remains. The euro itself is still fairly stable. Barrow believes that investors may reckon that some weaker countries could drop out of the euro, leaving the currency in the hands of Europe's strongest economies. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
More analysis and reporting now from the BBC's Andrew Walker, who's with us from London as well, with more on what could be a spreading frenzy of the European debt crisis. Hey, Andrew.
Good morning, Steve.
So what does it mean that we saw these interest rates for places like Finland, the Netherlands, and Austria shoot up too?
It means that financial markets are becoming increasingly concerned about the wider economic situation in the Eurozone and the possibility that some other governments might perhaps get into difficulty with their government debt. Some of those cases, it looks like a remote possibility. I have to say some of them do have very strong government finances, but it's a measure, I think, of just how concerned markets have become. The one I think is most worrying, though, is France, because France does have a little bit of a more precarious situation with its government finances. And of course, it's a really big one.
And is this a turning point, Andrew? We keep hearing about contagion and fears of contagion in the Eurozone. Is this it?
It's certainly a troubling development. I have to say that in early trading today, some of those interest rates have retreated a bit following reports of intervention in the bond market by the European Central Bank. But certainly it's conceivable that we might one day look back at the latest developments and see it as something of a turning point.
The BBC's Andrew Walker in London. Andrew, thank you.
My pleasure, Steve.
Over to China now, where the economy is growing at a brisk 9%. But is that enough to help pull the rest of the world out of recession? Some Chinese investors say no. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports.
It's called the China Venture Capitalist Confidence Index, and in its six-year history, confidence has never been lower. University of San Francisco's Mark Kinney says venture capitalists usually spend money on innovative companies.
But ultimately, it's very reliant on the fact that venture capitalists can sell those companies that they help create into public markets or through acquisition.
Problem is, the global economic crisis means there are fewer buyers. Last year, venture capitalists invested $4 billion into hundreds of deals in China. But responses to this survey show that economic turmoil in the EU and the U.S. have weighed heavily on the Chinese. They're even losing confidence in China's economy. Kenny says all this pessimism means investors in China will likely hold on to their money.
This means that there will be somewhat less innovation, somewhat fewer companies that are providing, you know, necessary products and services, and also ultimately there will be somewhat less employment than we would otherwise have.
Which is no way to pull the rest of the world out of a global downturn. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
This week, the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, said an increasing number of kids in Somalia are getting caught in the crossfire in violence there, terrible violence there. You know, Somalia has been in shambles now for more than 20 years, decades now.
And a lot of people have left Somalia, giving rise to an informal economy next door in Nairobi, Kenya, a place called Little Mogadishu. The first of three stories from East Africa now. Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
Here in Kenya, the big topic is immigration from Somalia. Most Somalis land in an edgy part of Nairobi called Eastleigh. Local economic analyst Robert Shaw.
It is almost like a state within a state. You can go there and you can get anything. And
you mean legal and illegal?
I'm sure there's both.
Cell phones, bootleg DVDs, what appear to be designer clothes.
So what if I just I'll give you 1,000 for all
No,
that?
It's not possible, brother. It's not possible.
So, but
we can't do that, perfect.
Eastleigh is booming, but the investment is hard to track. Eastleigh native Hussein Farah says deals here tend to be off the books.
In the Somali community, we don't go into a lot of writings. We work on what is known as mutual trust.
At least part of Eastleigh comes from what you and I would call the bad guys. Here's analyst Peter Pham at the Atlantic Council.
There was an explosion of development that somehow coincidentally was timed at the same time as the explosion in piracy and the explosion in ransoms.
It's not just pirates and ransom. Somalia's radical Islamic group Al-Shabaab has crafted a complex web of illegal trade, linked, of all things, to kebabs. First, Shabaab suppliers chop down Somali trees for charcoal, which then gets exported, says Rashid Abdi at the International Crisis Group.
The key destinations are actually the Middle East, and is primarily used in the hotel industry for charcoal grilling.
The proceeds buy sugar, which Al-Shabaab then smuggles into Kenya and sells on the black market.
The sugar you'll be having in a restaurant in Nairobi will probably be sugar that was imported through a business that is now increasingly controlled by Al-Shabaab.
It seems an open secret here in Little Mogadishu, the nefarious stirred in with the legit. But Abdi doesn't expect a crackdown. Why? Because the gray economy here is booming. Even in Kenya, it comes down to jobs. In Nairobi, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
A new survey over at careerbuilder.com, Jeremy, gives us a better idea of who's in charge of companies. This poll found a majority of executives bring their lunches to work. I didn't know that. Drive SUVs. I did know that. And apparently part their hair on the right.
Really?
Yeah. Where do you part your hair?
I don't part it.
You don't part it?
It's
you're kind of like
just
me. Just get out of the shower and just do it. You're done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all I do.
So the poll talks about company parties. I know we're about to get into the holiday season, and about a third of managers say they don't like to drink at company parties at all. But most who do drink wine or beer. But 3% say they take shots of liquor.
Company parties, they've got shots of liquor?
Well, some have open bars. Well, I mean, maybe it's not a party we know
we're
about.
We're working
here
at the wrong company, Steve. Where are
no
our shots?
No open bar, really. We did have the food truck, though, at last year's holiday. You remember that?
No, I wasn't here then.
No, you weren't. Of course you weren't.
So I was in New York.
That's all right. Maybe this year, Jeremy. Well, it's looking more and more likely, Jeremy, that there's not going to be a professional basketball season this year.
Don't remind me,
Steve. To your own dismay.
I know.
Yeah, talks between NBA players and owners fell apart this week, and the impasse has left TV networks scrambling to fill holes in their schedules. You know, I mean, you watch a lot of basketball on what? On ABC, on a lot of the Turner
TNT,
broadcasting?
Stuff like that,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to avoid losing millions of dollars in advertising revenue, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Sports fans, get ready for a lot of reruns. Brad Adgate is Senior Vice President of Research at Horizon Media. He says without live NBA games, regional sports networks like Comcast and Fox Sports will play a lot more talk shows and classic games from years past.
Their ratings are going to plummet, and you can see advertisers may pull out and decide to put their local dollars someplace else.
ESPN can fall back on other live sports like college basketball, but TNT also stands to lose out. For now, it's plugged holes left by the NBA with reruns of CSI New York. But Adgate says that's not likely to please advertisers. Basketball attracts a lucrative and hard-to-reach audience of young men.
These are the people who tend to watch less television. They're out playing, you know, all these video games that just came out.
One winner could be ice hockey. Adgate says NBA advertisers could move some of their money to the NHL. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
A new program will be teaching preschoolers in the Chicago area all about business. The Chicago Public Library is offering these classes and will be for the next 18 months using grant money from the PNC Foundation.
So in today's Midday Extra, we ask, how young should we start teaching our kids about money?
And here to talk about that is Sally McCready from the PNC Foundation. She's manager for the company's Grow Up Great program in early childhood education. She's with us from Pittsburgh, Steeltown, USA. Hey, Sally.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. So, you know, as I talked to Jeremy just a second ago, it was just a piggy bank for me to learn about how to save money and all that stuff.
Maybe a little allowance, some tooth fairy money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'd lose a tooth and I'd get 50 cents or a buck. Anyway, the Chicago...
All of which you'd spend on candy, I'm sure.
Yeah, to make the other teeth fall out. When I was a kid, you know, they gave us a piggy bank. My parents gave me a piggy bank and said, hey, here's an allowance. And you save money that way. I mean, what kinds of things will this program teach kids that we didn't learn years ago?
Well, I think it's a lot of the same similar lessons that if you learned to save your tooth fairy money years ago, that's part of this as well. But our friends at Sesame have put together this fantastic kit to help children at a very young age learn the basics of spending, saving, and sharing.
And when you say Sesame, you're talking about Sesame Street?
I'm talking about Sesame Workshop, yes, who are the producers of Sesame Street.
Yeah.
Well, why is this happening?
Well, I think as we thought a lot about the economic times, and especially the last few years, and really worked again with our partners at Sesame Street to see what the trending issues are in early childhood education, they really helped us understand that parents, especially of young children, struggle with how to introduce basic financial concepts with their kids, and that there was really a need to help parents introduce these simple lessons to their children.
You think, Sally, we're putting too much pressure on our kids to worry about money at such a young age? I mean, gosh, they have all their lives to worry about acquiring and spending money.
Well, I think the materials aren't really just about money. They're really basic lessons. The materials talk a lot about values and things we value, so not just money, but the relationships that we value, your special teddy bear that you value.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really broader. The materials are really much broader than talking about money.
And you know, that teddy bear could be worth some money. No, I'm just kidding.
That's true.
How do you go about teaching the kids these things? What are some of the methods that will be used to get them to have lifelong lessons learned from this?
Well, I think there's some really basic ideas that come through in the materials. Simple things like setting up 3 jars at home for spending, saving, and sharing. So when you do get that tooth fairy money, you can think about, do I want to run out and buy an ice cream cone or some candy?
Mm.
Or am I thinking more longer term that I really want that special toy that maybe costs $5 and should I put a quarter in my saving jar? Or do I want to, like Elmo does in the DVD that's in the materials, do I want to take 25 cents and give it to Cookie Monster to help him buy the cookie that he so much needs today?
Or maybe invest in stocks. No, we're probably not going to do that at age 5. Yeah, maybe so. I don't know.
That might be a little too much pressure for young children.
Well, Sally McCready from the PNC Foundation over in Pittsburgh. Sally, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sally.
Thank you very much.
And by the way, Jeremy, you know, Marketplace Money with Tess Vigeland has done a lot about teaching kids about money.
Yep.
You can find past episodes. I know they did this big episode where Tess was at a desk. I think it was from Portland, Oregon. And I remember this a couple of years ago. It was a fantastic episode. And you can find that at our website. Many other episodes just like that at our all-new website, jeremymarketplace.org.
And finally, Steve, of course, President Obama is down in Australia.
Yes.
And tomorrow he's going to be heading to Darwin, Australia, which is in the Northern Territory.
Yeah.
And the head of the local government there has a gift that he's going to be giving the president.
That's nice. Yeah. That's
he's going to be giving him an insurance policy
in case
he gets eaten by a crocodile.
In case he gets eaten by a crocodile. Are they really worried about this?
Just in case of a crocodile attack.
The president is down there. I hope he doesn't get attacked by a crocodile.
Well, the guy, the local government official, said that he wants to make sure that Michelle and the kids are taken care of him. They'll get $50,000 if anything should happen to the president.
Is that 50,000 Australian or 50,000?
That's a good question. I don't know if that's been stipulated in the insurance contract.
Doesn't the president make like $400,000? I'm sure they're probably taking care of it.
You know,
if
the one who's going to need the $50,000, Steve,
yeah,
is the Secret Service agent who's going to be fired immediately if the president gets eaten by a crocodile. That would be
not a good thing
to happen on your watch.
Do they when you like raise your hand, take the oath? I'll take a bullet for the president. I'll also take a bite from a crocodile.
I'm sure that they would.
Yeah.
Although I wonder if they're trained for something like that.
Mm.
You know, do they send them down to Florida to hang out?
It's time for the marketplace investigation to begin.
That's
this is what we're going to find out soon.
Well, in Los Angeles, where as far as I know, there are no crocodiles,
it's
I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Way too dry here. I'm Steve Chiantakis, by the way. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.